Welcome. The Center for Mind, Brain, and Culture is delighted to welcome Dr. Daphna Joel. Before I formally introduce Dr. Joel, I want to remind everyone that we're going to have a panel discussion directly following her talk and her question and answer period. So please stay with us for that discussion. Dr. Daphna Joel is a neuroscientist who received her PhD in psychology at Tel Aviv University. After receiving the Alon Fellowship for Young Israeli Scientists, Dr. Joel joined the faculty of Tel Aviv University. Dr. Joel's research has ranged from investigations of the neural circuitry involved in normal and abnormal behavior, primarily using animal models of psychopathology, to her recent work addressing questions related to brain, sex, and gender. Her research investigates the relationships between sex and brain structure and function, as well as on the perception of gender identity and sexual practices. Her work questions fixed assumptions regarding fundamental differences between male and female brains. In addition to numerous Too Many to Count journal articles and her public scholarship, Dr. Joel's recent book, Gender Mosaic, Beyond the Myth of the Male and Female Brain, outlines the proposal that every human brain is a unique mixture or mosaic of male and female features. We're extremely fortunate to have Dr. Joel here today, and I'm so excited to hear this talk and hear the discussion afterwards. Before we start, just a logistics note, we're asking that you reserve your, you know, big conceptual questions for the question and answer session at the end. But if you have questions of clarification, please throw them in the chat. And we will, I'll try to monitor, but Dietz will monitor as well. The title of Dr. Joel's talk is Beyond the Binary, Rethinking Sex and the Brain. And please join me in welcoming Dr. Joel.
Thank you. Okay. So thank you for having me and for this whole event with Liz Elliott's great talk yesterday and the panel today, which I'm also looking forward to. And I hope many of you have heard Liz talk yesterday about sex differences in the human brain. And I want to start my talk with an observation from a study of sex differences in the rat brain. And in that study, which I'll come back to it later with more detail, that study found that sex differences in the brain can be opposite under different conditions. That is, that what was typical of the brain of males was found in the brains of females under different conditions, and what was typical of the female brain was found in the brains of male under those other conditions. And this observation that sex differences could be opposite under different conditions threw me to a complete new way of thinking and talking and conceptualizing the relations between sex and the brain, which in a sense is orthogonal to the usual discussion about sex differences, how large they are, how much overlap there is, and whether the source is nature or nurture. So what I want to do today is talk about the binary conceptualization of the relations between sex and the brain, and then how it changes or how it changed following the challenges for the mosaic, from the mosaic hypothesis, which of course I will explain. And although I'll be talking mainly about the brain, we can discuss later some challenges to the binary conceptualization of gender and of sex itself. So let's start with the binary framework. And I want to start with a citation from Veronica Sanz. And she said that the problem with the sex binary is that there has never been a hypothesis or a theory to test. It is an epistemological framework that runs behind, above, and beyond particular theories and research projects. And I think this is very, very clear when you think about the sex binary as it is applied to the brain. Because for different scientists, a male and a female brain may mean very different things. So for some scientists, although this is rare to find today, but wasn't so rare up until like a decade ago, scientists could think of the male and female brain as two distinct systems. And I'm talking about scientists. I'm not talking about the Luan Brizendine and the male brain or the female brain. I'm talking about scientists studying sex differences in the brain and describing them as the brains of males and females belonging to two distinct systems. Today, it would be more common to find scientists talking about the typical female brain being different from the typical male brain, because they acknowledge that there is overlap between the brains of males and females, but they still keep this idea of the typical female brain being different from the typical male brain. Others think about brains as aligned along a male-female continuum, or a continuum between a typical female brain to a typical male brain. For example, the extreme male brain hypothesis of autism from Baron Cohen. And what's common to these three different, very different actually, formulations of the binary conceptualization of the relations between sex and the brain is that they all assume implicitly, always implicitly, that sex effects add up consistently within individual brains, creating either distinct systems or this continuum. And the mosaic hypothesis challenges this hypothesis, this assumption that sex effects add up consistently. And following this challenge, or actually the refutation of this assumption, a new formulation of the binary conceptualization of this relation, a new formulation emerged. And this is that brains are male or female because the brain structure can be used to predict sex category. So I will come back to this very, very different formulation of what a male and a female brain is at the more towards the end of my talk. But I want to start with this assumption, which again, I said, is usually implicit, that sex effects add up consistently within individual brains. And I strongly believe that this hypothesis comes from the fact that sex effects on the genitalia indeed almost always add up consistently within individuals to create one of two distinct systems, male genitalia or female genitalia. And to appreciate this, I brought these images. So on the right, you see a piece of art by an artist, Jamie McCartney, of the external genitalia of women. And on the left, you can see an equivalent great wall of male external genitalia, which I've created using Google Images, if you had doubts, but still you can imagine the type of ads I get since. But anyway, the reason I brought these up here is because you can see that although there are within sex category differences, so not all males look the same and not all females look the same, humans almost always have a set. Either they have a set of only female typical organs or a set of only male typical organs. And it is very rare that a baby is born with genitalia that is neither the male set or the female set, because of having one or more genital organs in the form intermediate between the male and the female, or because of having some male typical organs and some female typical organs. And these genitalia we usually term intersex rather than male or female. Now, when we have these images and we have a clear view of what we mean when we say male and female genitalia, it is quite clear to understand why when scientists started to discover sex differences in the brain, they implicitly used the logic of the genitalia, which is our logic when we think about sex, and applied it to the brain, assuming that similarly, sex effects on the brain also add up to create two distinct systems. And a study that really demonstrates very nicely, and Liz mentioned it yesterday. So this is a study in which they assessed the strengths of over 9,000 connections in the human brain. And this is a summary diagram which shows all the connections that were stronger on average in males compared to females, this is humans, in the upper panel, and stronger in women compared to men in the lower panel. The color code is blue for intrahemispheric connections and orange for interhemispheric connections. And this image as well as the text that accompanied it, which is male brains are like this and female brains are like that, assumes implicitly that what's typical of the male brain is to have male typical connections, and what's typical of the female brain is to have female typical connections. And this is the same logic as the genitalia. This is true of genitalia. What's typical of the female genitalia is to have only female typical organs. And what's typical of the male genitalia is to have only male typical organs. So they use this logic and apply it to the brain. They didn't test that it is true. They simply imply that this is, or simply assume that this is true. And actually it sounds quite reasonable to think that what's typical of males is to have male typical connections. It sounds almost as a truism, but it's probably not true. And the reason to suspect that it's not true is what I told you in the beginning, is that because the effect of sex on the brain, surely not on genitalia, may be opposite under different conditions. And before I explain why this leads to the fact that the typical male brain doesn't have only male typical collections and the same for the female typical brain. Before I do this, let me just show you one study which demonstrates this effect or this reversal of sex effects, because this is really, really important for everything that I have to say and for everything that I've been doing in the last decade in this field. So this is a study from the lab of Tracy Shores. I have done no studies in animals in the relation to sex and to the brain. And what they've studied is the density of dendritic spines. So you see here a neuron and the spines and the small red dots along the spines, along the dendrites are the spines. And we can see here a spine, a dendrite, sorry, from a male rat, and a dendrite from a female rat, and you can see the spines and the arrows point to the spines, and you can easily see a sex difference. So it's not a penis and a clitoris, but it's surely a morphological difference between the brains of males and females. So sex affects the brain. Usually when we hear that sex affects the brain, we immediately go on to conclude that there is a male brain and a female brain. And this is what I will try to dissociate the two parts of this sentence. Sex affects the brain. We have lots of evidence that sex-related hormones and chromosomes also affect the structure of the brain. But what I will try to show you is that this does not necessarily lead to there being a male and a female brain. And the reason is because how sex-related genes and hormones affect the brain can be opposite under different conditions. So in this study, there was another group of rats, and these rats underwent 30 minutes of stress one day before their brains were assessed. And again, we see a sex difference, but it is reversed. What we thought was typical of males, few spines, we now see in the female. What we thought was typical of males, we now see in the, in females, we now see in males. So sex affects the brain, but knowing a rat sex category, so knowing whether a rat is male or female, gives you no information about the structure of this specific part of the brain. So if you know that you're going to look at a dendrite from a female, you cannot guess whether she will have lots of spines or few spines, and same for males. Even though sex does affect her brain, and his brain. And this is because how sex affects the brain depends on other factors and may be opposite. So this is the first slide, which is of utmost important for me, because it demonstrates that the fact that sex affects the brain does not necessarily mean that there would be two types of brains. This type of reversal of sex effects have been shown for many regions of the brain. We were looking now at the hippocampus, but also for regions of the cortex, cerebellum, corpus callosum, amygdala, even regions of the hypothalamus. For many different features of the brain, We looked now at dendritic morphology, could be also receptor density, size of specific nuclei, etc., and following many different manipulations. Even housing the rats one to a cage or four to a cage can lead to the reversal of sex differences in the cortex. Also, stress experienced in utero, for example, can affect sex differences that we see in adulthood. So some, at least some of these reversals are long lasting. Now, when you look at all of these studies together, as I have done in 2011, what you realize is that these different manipulations do not flip the entire brain from the female form to the male form or vice versa. They change the form of only some brain features. So even if you assume that at some specific point, let's say now, my entire brain is in the female typical form, then following such an event, some of my brain regions will change their form, others will not, and I will end up with a mosaic brain. Mosaic in terms of having both female typical and male typical features. If we were talking about genitalia, we could call it intersex brain. But I'm not using intersex anymore because I was approached by intersex activists and they wanted to keep the name for the intersex genitalia, so we're using mosaic. So the mosaic hypothesis is exactly this, that brains will be a mosaic of female typical and male typical features. And this mosaic is a result of sex effects on the brain interacting in complex ways and differently for different brain features with many other factors. And it took a few years until I understood how to test the mosaic hypothesis in the human brain. And together with a colleague, Professor Yaniv Asaf, also from Tel Aviv University, and a group of students, we looked at brain images from about 1,400 humans. And we did many different analyses, you can see in the paper. I'm going to present only one, in which we divided each brain into 116 regions of gray matter using a very, very conventional method, VBM. And we assessed the volume of each of these regions in each brain and created this Excel file. I'm explaining because I'm going to use it. So in this file, each line is a single brain and it gives you the volume of 116 regions. And to appreciate sex differences in this sample, we use the color code. So green if a region is relatively large, yellow if it's relatively small, compared to this region in all other people in the sample. So let's look at this region, it is relatively large, it will be painted green. This region is relatively small, will be painted yellow. And this is what you get when you do the whole sample. So on the left, brains from men, on the right, brains from women, and you can, each line is a single brain, and you can easily see the differences. Women as a group have more green, meaning that they have more gray matter as a group compared to men. And this is a known finding with this type of correction for brain size as BBM does. And I don't want to go into this. So the question for me is not whether there are sex differences. You can see here that with at least with this system or this method, you get many differences on group level differences. I'm also not interested in the question of nature versus nurture. How did these differences get into the brains? I only want to know whether these differences add up consistently to create two types of brains, male and female, as almost always true for the genitalia, and as is often assumed to be the case for brains, or do the differences mix up in individual brains? And I think that when you look at these images, it is clear that brains are rarely green or yellow. Rather, most brains are composed of unique mosaics. Each brain is different. Unique mosaics of green, which is more typical of females, and yellow, which is more typical of males. So brains do not come in two types, male and female. Now, I want to stress that the different views, my view of the mosaic and the idea that the typical male brain is different from the typical female brain, they both stem from the same basic observation, which is that there are sex differences at specific brain features. So some people call me a sex difference denier, which means that they really don't understand what I do, because the whole point of the mosaic is that each person is a mosaic of female typical and male typical features. And you cannot have these if you do not have sex differences. But the point that is really important for me is we start from the observation that there are some sex differences in the brain. And then the question is, how do they add up in the whole brain? If they add up consistently, then you get this, that the typical male brain is different from the typical female brain. But if they mix up, then this is what you get. And please note that this shows the actual data. You see here every brain in our sample. This doesn't show actual data. This is a summary diagram. It is a way to present. So this is not an image of a human brain. This is a summary diagram. And in fact, we tested connectivity and we assessed the connections of over 4,000 connections in the human brain and chose only seven, showing the largest differences between women and men in our sample. And we couldn't find even a single person in which all seven connections were all in the male typical form or on in the female typical form. And over 60% had both male typical and female typical connections. So if we look at these images, there is not even a single person that has either only blue or only orange. And most humans have unique combinations of blue, which is more typical of men, and orange, which is more typical of women. Okay, so I'm coming back now to this idea that there may be differences in single features. The question is how they add up. And to illustrate this, I want to look at the largest differences currently known in the human brain. And Liz also mentioned these studies yesterday from the lab of Dick Swab. And this is post-mortem data about the regions of the hypothalamus. The INAH3, which is supposed to be the human analog of the sexually dimorphic nucleus of the of rats, and the INAH1. And you can see very large differences between men and women in the number of neurons in these nuclei. And what we did together was to draw the number of neurons, but together, not separately for each nucleus, but together. And this is what we got. So we have cisgender women, cisgender men, and there were some transgender women in green. And you can easily see the group level differences. So women are lower in both nuclei, which is the same data, so it has to be the same. But you can also see that there is no correlation between the number of neurons in the two nuclei. So someone can be high in both measures, can be high in one, but low in the other, high in the other, low in the first. Okay, so people are mosaic also for these currently largest known differences in the human brain. So it's not about whether there are differences, it's about whether they add up consistently. And it seems that they do not. If we go back to the 116 regions here, not just two, but over 100, then we can think of each brain as a single dot, not now in two-dimension space, but in 116-dimension space. So it's really difficult to imagine this. So what we've done here, this is the actual data that you see here. Each red dot is a brain of a woman and a blue is from a man. And the two dimensions here, we did PCA, principal component analysis. And the two components that you see here are the two that showed the largest sex differences for this sample. And when you look here, well, surely it doesn't look like the, you know, brains are separate, two distinct types, etc. But you can also move away from the idea that is quite common sense when you look at a single feature of a continuum between the male end and the female end. So when you move to even two dimensions, even the idea of a continuum sounds not relevant, not to use another word. And what you can start to think, or you can start thinking about brains in a very different way. So it seems that we all belong to a single, highly heterogeneous population. And we all belong here in this very dense, or most of us belong in this very dense center. And the number of men and women there is quite similar. But this center is surrounded by a sparse periphery. You can see it here. So there are not many people in this periphery, but in this periphery, you can see some large sex differences. So for example, in this region, there are many more men than women. There are not many men there, but of the people that are there, there are more men than women. Here you can see more women, here there are more women. So this periphery can show differences or large sex differences. And this may be important for the observation that again, Liz mentioned yesterday of large sex differences in psychopathology. So for example, and this is just speculation, okay? We don't know it, we don't have the information, but let's say that this region of space would be where people with autism are. So you can understand why there are more autistic men than autistic women without assuming that the typical male brain is a little autistic, or that the typical female brain is a little depressed, or that the typical male brain is a little has a little, you know, some attention problems, etc. So you don't need to assume that the center is moved toward the side where psychopathology is when you leave aside this metaphor, which is okay for single features, and even this is questionable, and I'll get back to this, but it's completely useless when you start thinking about brains in multi-dimension space. So up until now, this was just a hand waving, and I do this a lot, but we actually tested this. So I want to properly formulate the hypothesis and the alternative hypothesis and show you how we tested it. So my hypothesis is that the brain types that are typical of women are also typical of men and vice versa. And this is because most of us have mosaics of male typical and female typical features, but there may be large sex differences in some rare brain types. And you can also see it here. So for example, yellow brains are rare in the human population, but of the people that have a yellow brain, there are more men than women. So this is my hypothesis. The alternative hypothesis is that the typical male brain is different from the typical female brain. And we published 3 years ago a study testing this. And again, I'm just going to give you the feeling and of what we've done. And the first thing was to use anomaly detection algorithms to test whether the typical male brain is indeed different from the typical female brain. So anomaly detection algorithms, what they do, you give them data, they learn the data, and then you give them new data points, and they need to decide whether this is normal, so belongs to the data that they were trained on, or abnormal. So we gave the algorithm brains of one sex category, so let's say brains of women, and then the algorithm learns what a normal or a typical female brain is, and then we give the algorithm new brains of men, which of course it never saw, and of women that it was not trained on. And for each brain, it needs to decide whether this is normal or abnormal. And of course, then we do the same, but just training first on men and testing on men and women. Now, if the typical male brain is different from the typical female brain, then if I train on brains of women, then the algorithm should detect many more women as normal compared to men, because the typical male brain is different. And of course, the opposite if I train first on brains of men. However, if my description of the population of human brains is correct, then it doesn't really matter how you train the algorithm, first on men or on women. In both cases, the number of men and women that it will mark as normal should be similar. Why? Because whichever, it doesn't matter if you take the blue dots first or the red dot first, what the algorithm learns is what's typical of humans is to be in this dense center. And then it doesn't matter. So we have very clear predictions, which is great for science. And now we only need to test them. So to make sure that that our approach can detect two populations, if these existed in the data, we first use a positive control, which is thanks to one of my greatest opponents, which is Marco Delgaidis. And we use the facial morphology of two primate species. So these are really two populations, and let's see if the algorithm can detect it. For all analysis, we used the data both in the original space. In this case it was 190 features. And also following different ways or different methods of dimension reduction, some linear like PCA, others non-linear. And I'm not going to go into the details. The idea is to show that whatever we find is not a result or is not restricted to a specific type of dimension reduction or some other peculiarity of the data or of the method used to treat the data. And I'm going to show you the results because there are many runs of the algorithm here. So once when the model is built on macaques and then when the model is built on capuchins. And here we will see the ratio of capuchins classified as normal out of capuchins and the ratio of macaques classified as normal out of macaques. And what you can see is that the algorithm never makes a mistake thinking that a macaque is a capuchin or a capuchin is a macaque. So for example, if the algorithm was trained on macaques, then it never thinks that a capuchin is normal. So it never thinks that or classifies a capuchin as a macaque. And the other way around when it is trained on capuchins. So the algorithm can detect two populations if they exist in the data. Now what happens when you do the same with brains? So again, with all the dimension reduction, etc. And this is what you get. It's the exact opposite of the primate faces case. So all the dots, all the runs of the algorithm are aligned along the y equal x axis, meaning that the proportion of men that were classified as normal is very similar to the proportion of women classified as normal. And this is regardless of whether you trained the algorithm on men or women. And this is the same result with another data set. So this is completely in line with the way I described to you how best to think about human brains. Most of us are in this dense center. And this is what's typical of humans, to be in this dense center. So the typical or the brain types typical of women are also typical of men and vice versa.
Daphne, may I ask a clarification question?
Yeah.
Were these trained on the periphery male-female or on the center male-female?
No, we just took half of the sample. So for example, here we had 600 or so females. So we took 300 females just randomly. And then this is a training set. And then you test on the other half of the females. So we don't choose the center, but if you randomly take half of the sample, then most of the sample always is in the center because this is where most people are. So you don't need to do this. This just happens because this is how brains are arranged if you think of them in a multidimensional space.
True, but if you trained on the periphery, then you'd be able to discriminate. And this is a better positive control than even your capuchin macaque, no?
We'll go back to the question of prediction, which I think this is what you're asking in a few minutes, okay? But now I'm not trying to predict which one is male or female. What I'm trying to do is anomaly detection, which is something else. I ask the algorithm to learn what's a normal, let's say female brain, and then to decide whether male brains are normal. And if the typical male brain was different from the typical female brain, then many brains of men should be classified as abnormal because they are not normal female brains. And what we see is that this is not the case. So the same number of brains of males as the number of brains of females are classified as normal female brains or are normal male brains. What the anomaly detection algorithm does not answer, it doesn't answer anything about the abnormal brains. So we don't know whether there are sex differences in rare brain types, because it tells us something about the typical, not about the atypical. And rare brain type is atypical. So to this, we used another approach, which is unsupervised cluster analysis. So now we give the algorithm all the information, so the entire sample, 1200 brains, but without information about the sex category. So this is what it gets. So you see no information about which one is from a male and which one is from a female. And we ask the algorithm to find two clusters that best describe variability in the population that it just received, and then three clusters, four, and we went up to 10 clusters. And we used two different clustering algorithms, k-means and hierarchical clustering. And again, it's just to show that it's not specific to one approach. And of course, all the different ways to do dimension reduction. And after we have, let's say, two clusters or three clusters, and this is just for illustration, then we know which is male and which is female. So we assess the percent of females and the percent of males in each of these clusters. Now for the predictions. If the typical male brain is different from the typical female brain, then we should expect to find at least two large clusters, one with mainly male brains and the other with mainly female brains. However, if the typical male brain is the same as a typical female brain, then we expect that large clusters, large meaning that they have most of the observations or most of the samples there, and this is typical human brains, they would have similar numbers of men and women, because this is a typical human brain, and women and men have typical human brains. However, in small clusters, which represent rare brain types, then we should expect, at least in some of them, to see large sex differences. So again, we have very clear predictions and different predictions. And this is the result. So I'm showing you the proportions of males or females in each cluster, just the larger of the two. So it starts from 0.5 and goes up as a function of the size of the cluster. And what you can see is what I described. So with the large clusters, the number of men and women is almost the same. But when you go to very small clusters, so 100 brains and less, then you can see some very large, not all of them, but some very large sex differences. So for example, here it will be six times more men or women compared to the other sex. Okay, so you can see very large sex differences in small clusters. But we have, again, from another method, we have a converging evidence that the typical or the brain types typical of women are also typical of men, and vice versa. When you have this clustering, what you can do is you can also calculate the chances that a male and a female would be in the same cluster, assuming that this is captures some important variability. Maybe it doesn't, but if it does, then being in the same cluster means that you have the same brain type. So we can calculate the chances that a male and a female would be in the same cluster and compare it to the chances the two men or two women would be in the same cluster. And what we found is that the chances are very, very similar. This means that knowing that I am female gives you almost no information about how likely my brain is to be similar to yours, depending on whether you are male or female. If we just compare it to the genitalia, then it gives you even more information than you ever thought you'd need, okay? So we see again that sex category, and we saw it in the rat, sex category provides little information on whether two brains and how two brains would be similar or different. So I hope I convinced you that sex effects do not adapt consistently within individual brains. And as a result, Of course, brains of males and females do not belong to distinct systems. It's also not true that the typical female brain is different from the typical male brain. And it's also wrong to think about brains as aligned along a male-female continuum. Not that you cannot do this mathematically, but it makes no sense functionally or physiologically. But the response to our work, and specifically to our 2015 study, which showed the mosaic in the human brain, was a new formulation of the binary. And this new formulation states that because you can predict the sex category from brain structure or function, then brains are indeed male or female. And I want to start with what's true about this. So it is true that if you take brain structure or brain function, you can predict, and the accuracy depends. If you do not correct for brain size, it can reach to up to 90% correct, the predicting the sex category of the brain's owner. If you correct for brain size, then it drops to 70%, still better than chance. So you get some, you can predict sex category, better or worse, on the basis of brain structure. So this is true. The question is this meaningful? Is this new definition or formulation worth keeping, just to keep the binary formulation of a male and a female brain? So I want to talk about this now, about the question of prediction. And so this is a study, a review paper just published that reviews everything, if you're interested. So to understand the question of prediction, let me go to another domain, and this is predicting the sex of an author on the basis of the text. So almost 20 years ago, several scientists from Bar-Ilan University showed that you can take a text and predict using machine learning, you can predict whether it comes from an author, for a male or female author. And you take this formula, you put in the correct number of V, A, sum, number of numbers, etc. And if the product of this formula is less than the total number of words in the book, then the author is female. And if it's larger, then the author is male. And this was 80% correct, which is even better than what you get in the brain. Now, the reverse is also true. So if you know that the author is, let's say, female, and you can predict with 80% chance to be correct, that the product of this formula would give you a number smaller than the total number of words in the book. Now, the question is this interesting? Does it mean that there are male and female books, etc.? And I want to raise two points here. The first is that I don't think the information that is here is the first thing that you would like to know about a book, the number of possessive pronouns, for example. Probably would want to know its genre, whether it's a romance or popular science book, how long it is it interesting, and maybe some other questions. So first, the fact that you can use this information to predict the sex category of the author doesn't mean that this is an important part of the variability that you want to explain about a book. The other thing is that even if these 10 features were the most important things for you about a book, knowing that the author is female or male will give you no information about these most important features. And this is because there is an endless number of solutions to this equation, okay? And the same is true for brains. So it is true that you can use this information to predict whether the brain owner is female or male. Simply what you can think about it is that females on average will have more female typical than male typical features, and the reverse would be true for males. So you can predict that if I'm female, then probably I have more female typical than male typical features in my brain. However, that's it. You do not know how many of each, and of course you do not know which one are in the male typical form and which are in the female typical form. So what actually you can do is, if you know I'm female, then you can predict that, or you can say that had you known the form of my brain, you would have 70 or 80 or 90% chance to correctly predict that I'm female. Sounds a little circular, right? Now, this is not true about genitalia. So with genitalia, it is true. Knowing that I'm female, you can predict that had you seen my genitalia, you would have 100% chances to correctly predict that I'm female. So this is similar. But what's different is that you would know much more than that to predict that I'm female. Knowing that I'm female gives you information that I only have female typical organs. Maybe I lost some of them on the way, but I would have only female typical organs and no male typical organs. So you gain much more information about knowing that I'm female or male about my genitalia than you get about my brain. So the question for me is not whether we can use brain structure or function to predict sex category, but whether sex category predicts brain structure. Usually we know whether people are male or female. We don't need to put them in the MRI to predict their sex category. The question is, knowing sex category, can we predict brain structure? And I want to argue that sex category is not a major predictor of human brain structure. And of course, this goes to what Liz talked about yesterday, about the size of the differences. But I also want to remind you this, when you look at the multidimensional space, when you look at how the differences, even if they are small, how they add up in the brain and they mix up. And therefore, we see here that sex category doesn't provide information about brain structure. And I want to end, I want to end with some evidence from function, and this is not from my studies. So this is a study about the neural substrates of sexual arousal. And you can see here sex differences in the brain response to sexual stimuli in different regions. Most studies would stop here. And the conclusion and the title would be sex differences in the neural substrates of sexual arousal. However, this group did not stop here. And they compared the variability explained by sex, marked here, to the variability explained by other factors, such as age, hemisphere, type of stimulus. And you can see that sex explained the least amount of variability in the neural response to sexually arousing stimuli. Even machine power, whether the MRI was 1.5 Tesla or 3 Tesla, explained more variability than sex. And they rightly titled the page, the paper, neural substrates of sexual arousal are not sex dependent. So the question is not whether sex explains some variability and whether this variability can be used, and it can be used, to predict sex category. The question is whether sex category explains a lot of the variability in brain structure. And as we see here, I showed you not in brain structure, and you can also see here in brain function. And the last study, and I wish I have done this study, but I haven't. So this is a great study, and Liz mentioned it yesterday, so I'll go over this quickly. And this is looking at the number of significant sex differences in the MRI, functional MRI studies, as a function of the size of the sample. Now, if a division into male and female brains by prediction, by whatever means you wanted, if there was some way in which brains of females and males were meaningfully different, then you would expect that the larger the sample, the more differences you would find. However, if we all belong in a single highly heterogeneous population, then you should not expect this relation. And there was no relation between the number of differences in the size of the sample. So yes, it is true that brain structure can predict sex category, but sex category, the reverse prediction is meaningless, basically. And we don't have time to this, so I'm not going to talk about testing the masculinization hypothesis, and I will end here. And I think we have some time still for discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Joelle. Thank you so much. If you have a question, we'll have some few moments to do some Q&A with Dr. Joelle and then move on to the panel discussion. If you have a question, if you'd raise your hand or put it in the chat, and then we can call on folks. Larry, it looks like you have a question.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out how to raise my hand. Very nice talk. I just wanted to ask about limitations on the resolution of looking at human circuitry. You know, so you're talking about sort of brain imaging and anatomical studies, but in behavioral neuroscience, we're getting, in animal work, getting much finer resolution in terms of cell type specific circuits, and we can identify in rats sex difference in circuits that maybe are controlling things like ovulation or things like that. And I wonder if maybe in humans there are sex differences in some circuits that we just can't see that are much more defining.
So for sure there are sex differences in the circuits of controlling ovulation, right? And also in the on the circuits controlling the muscles that are or the innervation of the muscles of the basic of the penis, right?
And parental care.
What?
Maybe parental care as well.
Oh, so now you're moving to behavior, right? So and see how easily you made this jump and this leap. And here, even in animals, and this is what I showed you in the human hypothalamus and also in animals, you see this mosaic. So it's like, you jump from something that only females or only males have, like ovulation or a penis. And then you continue to something that is behavior, that even in some animals, parental behavior is not something that only mothers do, also fathers do, surely in primates, but also in some kind of types of rodents. I don't see why we should do this jump. And also in animal studies of parental behavior, I don't follow all of this literature, at least the ones I know from, for example, even most recent work from Tali Kimchi from Weizmann Institute, that the circuitry is the same. And you can find the circuitry in males and females, and it's regulated by hormones. So the behavior may be different, but not because the circuitry is different.
Right, so it's chemistry difference, not circuit difference.
So I didn't understand?
It's chemistry difference and not circuit differences.
I wouldn't call it chemistry differences, but I wouldn't want to go, because we can argue this, but I think the problem with most animal studies is that they control so well for all the behavior, so all the environmental measures, that it's difficult to see the mosaic. And in studies that do test under several conditions, then you can start seeing the mosaic. So for me, the interesting question is to, for example, if you measure the stress response and you compare it in males and females, then look at conditions that you have a normal treatment of the pups when they are young versus stressful treatment, and then look at the effects of in older age. And the few studies that did test this, they show this type of reversal of sex differences, etc. So if you want to see or appreciate how the environment affects sex differences, you cannot test animals in only one environment.
I think Erwin has raised his hand.
Yes, thanks. Thanks for calling on me. Thanks for a very nice talk. If you go back to that study in Scientific Reports, the one you wish you had done, I think there's actually a third hypothesis you didn't mention. So you mentioned the hypothesis that, you know, there would be sex difference findings and then the null finding. But if you go back to that graph, if you could show it, I think the third hypothesis is that in smaller studies.
Can you see it now?
I think it's one more back.
Yeah, I know. I just didn't know.
Yeah, I could see your slides, but not that particular slide.
Yeah, this one.
Yeah, there we go. If you freeze there. So I think that there's possibly a third hypothesis, which is that in smaller studies, you'd be more likely to get false positives. That is to show differences when there really aren't in a broader, you know, collection of participants and samples. And I think if you look at the graph, that could be so. If you fit a curve, it might start out very high when sample sizes are very low, and then asymptote down as you get to larger and larger samples. So it would have been interesting for the authors, or if it's possible to get access to their data, to fit such a curve and see if it bears out that third hypothesis that there are actually more false positives in smaller samples, which is what, you know, large bodies of literature show that review, you know,
I agree, but I just don't think this is a third hypothesis. I think it's the same as my hypothesis, because if you believe that we all belong to a single highly heterogeneous population, then the only thing that the differences that you do find are false positives. And then this is why you get many of them in small samples and you don't get them in large samples. So for me, it's the same. So the way I usually present this data is as, you know, showing that these are false positives. And indeed, as the samples are larger, you stop getting them. And then you don't get differences.
Yeah, I think the one difference is that in your figure and in your description, there's no relation with sample size. And in the hypothesis that I'm bringing up, it's actually worse. It's actually a statement on the published literature, which is that, you know, the smaller samples yield what one might regard as illusory positive findings. And it would be good to know about that in addition, I suppose. That's all.
Right. Okay, yeah. I agree. And I think it stems, so we put so much importance of sex category as a social variable that we can really find it very hard to let go of believing that sex category is also important in the brain. Even though we get so much evidence that it's not an important factor in the brain. But we cannot give up on this because it's such an important, so we just cannot believe it has to be there, and we keep looking, and this is what we get. We get a lot of false positive results, because if you look good enough, and especially with MRI, when you can, functional MRI, especially when you can do thousands and thousands of comparisons, you will, if you look for differences, you will find them. Just need to look hard enough, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry to interrupt, Daphna. There was one question written into the chat from Greg Burns, and he asked, if there aren't male and female brains, are there other, like, can we use other categories? Are there definable types, say type A, B, C, et cetera?
Yeah, so this is a great question. And I think this is where we should go. So I think we should start looking at variability in human brain and start to attempt to correlate it with variability in output. So for example, different types of psychopathologies, et cetera. And going through the male and female brain wouldn't get us far. So one of the problems, I think, with the new formulations of the binary is that now you can see many studies, too many studies, creating or giving each brain a score on how likely it is to be a male or a female brain. So first you create and use cluster analysis, but supervised cluster analysis to create this distinction between male and female brain. And then you use this to calculate the posterior probability that the brain comes from, let's say, a male. And then you use this probability as a covariate or you correlate this measure with whatever, with psychopathology, with femininity, with masculinity, etc. And sometimes you find some results. But this is taking a tiny part of the variability of the human brain, focusing all the attention on it, because you decide from the beginning that this is the most important part of the variability of the brain that you need to explain. And then you restrict yourself to this tiny part of the variability and try to predict other things. So this focus, almost obsession on the male and female brain, this idea, divert us from looking at the entire variability of the human brain and trying to correlate this with whatever outcome we're interested in. And for this, you need unsupervised measures. You cannot decide from the beginning that the male-female continuum is the most important and then restrict yourself also to only to this. So I hope this answers. And then maybe, yes, maybe there are 10 types of brains. I don't know. We need to start doing this, these studies.